other needs and bring forth a dedicated source. We probably will be not stop attempting to do that, because we believe not only the strength of our troopers 24 hours is needed, but I represent, we do, LEDS, Law Enforcement Data System, which impacts cities, counties. We're also the people who do the background check on folks going to work in your nonprofits to make sure they're appropriate for that agency. And we do the other work that supports our law enforcement component inside the state police. We appreciate your consideration and the help you can give us. I just wanted to be forward with you that we will be working on a dedicated fund simultaneous to a dedicated general fund, and we will not stop until the session's over. And even when it's over, we may well look beyond the session. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, were you going to follow up? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs, always pleased to be sitting up with my friends from labor, working together on an issue, and with Mr. Groner and ASCME, the chiefs, the district directors, and others have worked very hard on a number of issues, State Fire Marshal's office budget being one of the premier ones. For the fire chiefs, I also represent the Volunteer Firefighters Association. The State Fire Marshal's Office is a vital partner to the local fire jurisdictions in promoting fire and life safety. When we fail to adequately fund that Fire Marshal's Office, it really does handicap our ability to do in the field, particularly in the rural areas of the state, what needs to be done to protect our citizens from fire and the loss that comes along with that. So we want to strongly encourage the legislature this session to fund the Fire Marshal's Office, the OSP arson unit, at the level that's proposed in the governor's budget. We also strongly want to encourage, even though I don't have much detail to talk about on this today, but the Oregon Wireless interoperability piece, that's a critical component to public safety as far as the fire chiefs are concerned and is one of our high priorities. You've got some uniforms in the room, some people who can talk more eloquently to the issues than I, but I do want to run down the short list of the things that are most important to the fire chiefs and the volunteers with respect to the Fire Marshal's Office. Number one, planning and coordination of resources and response under the Emergency Conflagration Act. That's where we get into the fire insurance premium tax issue, and that's something that we care greatly about. We want to encourage this legislature to continue to fund conflagrations through the general fund and not through the fire insurance premium tax. We believe that that's a critical funding source for the other pieces of the budget for the Fire Marshal's Office. Fire investigation activities, fire safety inspection training, enforcement of statutes regulating the storage and use of combustibles and explosives, enforcement of statutes relating to fire protection equipment standards, enforcement of statutes relating to fire prevention, assistance in training rural and volunteer firefighters, and that's a critical piece in so many, especially with Measure 5 and Measure 50. As things have compressed out in the rural parts of the state, these jurisdictions absolutely depend upon the Fire Marshal's Office to help keep training up to a level that is of some meaningful use to our citizens out there. And then finally, administration of the state's urban search and rescue team. The specific requests, that USAR team, the urban search and rescue, that's about $380,000 of general fund. Protecting the use of the fire insurance premium tax for statewide fire prevention training and investigation activities. I believe that's about $780,000. And then, as I've already referenced, using the state's general fund to pay for conflagration costs, not through the fire insurance premium tax. With that, I do have some other people who can speak more intelligently about specific pieces of it, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have about what I was able to cover.
Any questions for Mr. Armstrong?
Thank you very much
for your testimony.
Mr. John McDowell. I'm Gary Seidel, and I'm going to come up with you.
For the record, my name is John McDowell. I'm with Springfield Fire Department. I'm also task force leader with Oregon Task Force 1 and Operation Committee Chair. Mr. Chair and committee members, I have handouts for you there, and don't be dismayed. I'm not going to go through all those pages. Quite a bit of that is letters in support from the 10 departments that are involved, as well as the Oregon Emergency Managers Association. Just a short background. After the events of 9/11, State Fire Marshal Bob Garrison at the time pulled the fire service in the state and asked what capability would we have to respond to significant structural collapse. And the answer was not much. Even departments like Portland didn't have the resources to handle something like that. So an invitation was sent out to all the departments in the state to see who wanted to participate in urban search and rescue. 10 departments replied back, and along with the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Oregon Sheriff's Association, the Oregon USAR Board was formed. It's governed by a governance board, and there are committees on that. Then the work began. We actively pursued grants, and with that we purchased 3 used 53-foot semi-trailers, and we equipped them with about $1.1 million worth of specialized rescue equipment. They're all identically equipped, and they're stationed in Clackamas, Salem, and Eugene. And then we looked at the FEMA urban search and rescue teams, and we saw what position descriptions they had and what training they had, and we mirror that. So we have provided approximately $550,000 worth of training that's FEMA equivalent to our task force members. As of January 1st last year, we were officially recognized and we're up and running as a task force. I'd like to read the mission statement very quickly. It's in this trifold, and you can look at that later at your convenience. And the mission of Oregon's Urban Search and Rescue Task Force 1 is to provide highly specialized technical rescue services to local jurisdictions that are overwhelmed by natural and man-made disasters. All of the money that has gone into setting up the program has come from grant dollars as well as significant out-of-pocket costs from the 10 participating fire departments. So what we have at this point is a state response resource that has been significantly funded by local dollars. We have a functioning team, but we need to add some additional members, and we need to provide additional training for manager-level positions. And if you turn to page 3, I believe it is, in your handout, that's a chart, again, you can look at your leisure. That's what a 35-person Oregon urban search and rescue deployment looks like. So at the bottom is what these people like to affectionately be known as rock breakers. These are the people that are doing the work, but higher up there are manager-level positions, and these positions still need additional training to be able to operate efficiently at a scene. My personal background is 26 years in the fire service, 20 years in specialized rescue, and in the beginning there was no such thing as technical rescue, just let's go out and perform rescue. It's become very sophisticated since then. The equipment is much better. The training bar is much, much higher, and that's where it needs to be because of the incredible danger that's involved in this type of response. The fire service, if you've been familiar with it, they respond to these type of incidents, and they will try and do the job to the best of their ability. But the problem is without the right amount of training, the right amount of equipment, they'll still go in there, but the outcome is not going to be as good as it would be with proper training and proper equipment. Rescuers will be injured, possibly killed. Victims that were salvageable will not be rescued. So we're at a critical point now where we have an up-and-running team, but we need support so we can maintain the training that we need to perform our mission. We come to you today with not just an idea on a napkin. We come with a fully formed task force. Each of our departments have provided at least 200 hours of training just to get our people to where they could apply to the state team, so we bring a lot to the table. And we're asking support in the amount of $388,000 appropriation from the general fund for Oregon Urban Search and Rescue. I sent you all a copy of this request as well as this budget last week. Thank you.
Questions? Fire away.
My name is Gary Seidel. I'm the fire chief of the city of Hillsborough. Been up here for 4 years. I'm going to talk on 5 fronts. I'd like to talk as a member of the federal USAR Emergency Task Force. Been with them for 20 years. Was with LA City Fire Department. Also like to talk as a responder who responded to numerous disasters. I was at Oklahoma for 7 days. I was at the Pentagon for 2 days and then transferred up to the World Trade Center for 27 days. I was also at the Northridge earthquakes, was there for 4 days, and since I was in our background, LA City, was there for an additional significant amount of time to make sure that Northridge was occurred and taken care of. Also responded to the floods of 96 as well as the floods of North Dakota. Also responded to the Columbine High School shooting and was also asked to be part of the incident management team up at the Park City Olympics in 2002. Also like to discuss it from another perspective as a subject matter expert for FEMA Urban Search and Rescue. I was a task force leader with FEMA Urban Search and Rescue, was an operations section chief. Like I said, I spent 27 days at the World Trade Center in charge of night operations for search and rescue. Also spent a lot of time as a search team leader, rescue team manager, and a weapons of mass destruction USAR technician. Part of our focus for FEMA USAR was also to develop the Urban Search and Rescue Task Forces for weapons of mass destruction. This was in 2000. However, on September 11th, we were getting ready to kick off our training for weapons of mass destruction for USAR Task Force when the events of September 11th took hold, and we had another mission, basically get to the Pentagon, and like I said, get up to the World Trade Center. I've also been heavily involved since I came up here in 2004 with Oregon's State Urban Search and Rescue. One thing about an urban search and rescue team, when you look at it, right now only 3% of the resources in the state can respond to an urban search and rescue arena that comes into play. We need the numbers. And if you look at and depend on a federal emergency urban search and rescue task force to come in, even with the governor's declaration, it'll take you approximately 24 hours to get the closest resource on scene. After 24 hours, we're down to 30% survivability rate to be able to effect search and rescue. That 90% that we can do in the first few hours is basically a state's response to deal with the state response coming in. When we look at the element that comes in on being able to survive victims, to search, to find them from the various means, and to be able to hopefully have a successful rate of saving those victims, it takes time, it takes money, as John talked about, it takes equipment. We have the equipment, we have the personnel that are trained up. As a fire chief for the city of Hillsborough, I can tell you that even though we've had three grants to help fund this, city of Hillsborough has also paid an additional $85,000. I don't know how much longer our city or my city manager is going to allow me to continue to spend City of Hillsborough monies for a state resource. We realize that this resource is viable not only to the state, but it's viable to any one of our cities and with mutual aid. Only 44% of the cities in Oregon have mutual aid agreements for state urban search and rescue. So one thing I can tell you as a fire chief for the City of Hillsborough, one of the 10 signatories on the ORS 190 agreement, I guarantee if you fund this, I will make sure that we spend this money to the stewardship and to the ethics that we've been asked to do so. I will also make sure as one of the fire chiefs that we do talk to the governance board and we make sure that they come up with a funding resource in here instead of coming back every couple of years to try to acquire more money. But like I said, as one of the responders that has responded to numerous disasters, this resource is a vital resource to be able to provide support and safety to the citizens of Oregon. Be happy to answer any questions. If not, I thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Yeah, so your training, do you use John Minnis's outfit down here, the DS?
DPSST, we do use them for some of the education and some of the grant monies that have come in. We've done quite a few courses that have come in, such as Incident Command for Structure Collapse. We've provided that to roughly about 80 fire chiefs throughout the state of Oregon. We're about to do another class in May. So we do use DPSST for providing some monies to be able to assist us. The facility is also in the process of starting, hopefully, to build a structure collapse site. So we will have a site within Salem to be able to continue to advance our trainings. Most of our resources that John talked about do come out of FEMA. We've tried to make sure that we stay equivalent to FEMA, knowing that if all of a sudden we train, we come out there, we want to make that transition seamless. So all of a sudden, when you have a local responder, state responder, when federal responders come in, it's a seamless transition. We can all work together. So we've trained to the federal levels to make sure that we're all equivalent for that such response.
Senator Nelson has a follow-up to that. The grants are very specific about what type of training we can receive, and it has to be FEMA equivalent training, and it has to be by instructors on the FEMA list, and that limits us to certain companies that provide that training. One of our goals right now is, I know in Chief Seidel's department, he sent several people to train the trainer courses so they can become those on that FEMA list, so we'll have a economy of savings when we can have our own Oregon in-house instructors, and they can instruct the same class at the DPSST facility. But right now, that structural collapse training class costs about $100,000 for 20 students.
Just a follow-up, too.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, this is my theme in this thing is that if you do something in one area, it has an effect someplace else. I'm thinking it seems like the co-chair's budget has substantially lessened the DPSST budget. So is that going to affect these folks coming down there and getting training?
I'll pass that off to the professional staff for a response.
Mr. Chair, the reductions, and Senator Nelson, the reductions in the DPSST budget are generally on the law enforcement side for CFAA. Any funding that was dedicated in the governor's budget for fire training, and this may be sort of a mixture, but I'm not sure, was not affected by the co-chair's budget. It was the law enforcement CFAA-funded side of it.
That follow-up, please, Mr. Chair. That brings up the question, if we fund more state police, then is the training at the DSSPT... We're going to cut the training center. How's that going to help us when we fund more state police or these folks? I mean, that's my point here.
I think your point is extremely well taken. We have to make sure that we have enough money to fund all aspects of it, not just one large aspect.
I mean, we cut all them in?
You knew what I was going to say, Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, can I respond to Senator Nelson?
Please.
Senator Nelson, even if DPSST is not able to provide the training at this point, we can still contract with an outside contractor to receive the training at several locations, either in Eugene or the Portland area. It would be advantageous for us to pursue that and see if we can get the cost down, but at this point, we can still do the training without the DPSST board.
And just before we go to Representative Nathanson, my understanding is this has not been part of the governor's recommended budget or the co-chairs. It's something you're interested in getting tested.
That's correct. And I'd also like to make it clear that what we're asking for is appropriation of an additional amount to go into the fire marshal's budget to administer strictly to USAR. We're not asking for money to be taken from the existing fire marshal budget. We wouldn't support that, and we withdraw our request if that was in fact the case.
Course. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question first for Mr. McDowell and for whichever wants to respond. I had the benefit of being able to have a briefing and a tour of one of these trailers to see the equipment and understand better what the training is and what the responsibilities would be. Could you please remind me and explain to the committee here what region is covered by the trailer that you showed me?
Certainly. Mr. Chair and Representative Nathanson, if you turn to page 4 in your handout, you'll see that the Oregon Urban Search and Rescue Program is broken into two regions, the north and the south region. The line, you would actually be in the south region where we're sitting right now. So the trailer that's in Eugene would respond in the south area. The Clackamas trailer would respond in the north. If we needed an additional trailer to support two teams, we could take the Salem trailer and it could go in either direction. And I also point out that the trailer... the Salem trailer is at the ODOT facility here, and if anybody wanted to set up a field trip to go and visit and look at that trailer and look at the equipment, I'd be happy to set that up.
And a follow-up.
Yes.
So my follow-up comment, I don't know if it needs a response. It might elicit a response from someone. The state relies on this program, but as we've just heard in the testimony and as I'm looking through the letters here, the state relies on this, but the state doesn't have anything to do really with funding it other than giving everyone a pat on the back and saying, great job. So when I look at the letters, for example, a letter that was written to Senator Westland by the fire chief in my city, Randall Groves, which explains that, it really begs the question for me, okay, we've had these local departments, for example, my city, Eugene, and our neighboring city, sister city, Springfield, collaborate very closely on this. And then you have 8 other local districts that are taking care of this responsibility for the whole state. If they figure out, as budgets become even tighter, or as county payments are reduced and other burdens start falling on cities and the state, as they reduce budgets, how many of these local in a way it's a charitable contribution, is anyone going to pull out? If we have one or more local agencies that pulls out of its obligation, then that leaves the state less protected. I can't in good conscience say unprotected, but much less protected. And what happens if all of them decide rather simultaneously they can't afford to shoulder this burden then, subsidizing the activities for the whole state? I'm just wondering how we can set up a program and then not make sure that it can be sustained.
Well, how was the trailer in Clackamas with the Elgin?
Good question. Do you all want to respond?
Go ahead.
Most of the money that we're seeing right now does come out of Department of Homeland Security. But if the grants do dry up, then we are going to be burdened a little bit more. Like I said, for the city of Hillsborough, over the last 3 years, it's $85,000 that we've put into this program. Not only $85,000 for the program, but it does benefit me back in the city of Hillsborough. Should all of a sudden Washington County have an emergency, then yes, I do have trained people, I do have resources, I do have equipment. But yet we're continuing to go on and on to be able to support any event we do have a state disaster to be able to meet that needs until we can get federal resources in here. And so right now, like I said, we've been very proficient with the grants that have been able to come forward.
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, a little bit of history. Of the original 10 departments that signed up, two of them, Bend Fire Department and Marion County, have had to drop off of the task force because of the concerns that Chief Seidel has cited as far as finding money in their budget to do the additional training that they would normally have to do for their own department to support their participation on the state team. Coming from, I never like to threaten anybody, but I would have to say, coming from Springfield, we were fortunate to get on in the beginning when there was a lot of grant money and a larger proportion of the training was being paid for. Right now, the class for the rock breakers that I was talking about on here, we have additional people we need to send to that. We have received a scholarship for the tuition, but as far as the rest of the backfill, because fire departments operate on 24-hour constant manning, and so if I go to a class, someone has to replace me. That cost is approximately $3,500. So if today Springfield was to try and provide the 18 team members that we have to the state at $3,500 apiece, we would not be able to participate.
I'd like to add on for one little thing if I could. What John alluded to, basically what we're trying to do is we're trying to bring train-the-trainer instructors. To stay within this program, we do have to have a senior FEMA instructor. I meet that requirements for at least four of the elements that come into play, so that has been able to save us some money. Like I said, we've been also to send some of our employers and employees back to get trained as an instructor, train the trainer in there. What that does, that lessens the cost so we can continue to provide training and move people around. So we are trying to be a little bit more fiduciary in our responsibilities to meet that need.
We appreciate that. I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair. One more question for Senator Brown, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you. Could you help me understand why having a trailer in Clackamas is helpful to folks in Lawson or Enterprise in Wallowa County? I mean, is it just shorten the time to get there? I mean, obviously it's a state funding issue, but wouldn't it make sense to have more trailers? Is really a trailer in Clackamas going to help Dave's folks?
Chair Shields and Senator Brown, originally the state was divided into three regions, and one of them was an east of the Cascades region. Ben was participating, Redmond was going to participate, and we were going to have a trailer in that location. When they were unable to provide the personnel and they thought it was too expensive, they pulled out. So the task force travels together anyways, so if the people are coming from the Portland metro area to go over there, there's no difference having a trailer pre-stage in that location versus having it move with that task force from Portland to that location.
When you also look at the FEMA side, as far as USAR task forces, there's only 28 task forces for the nation. So what that means is usually there's one task force for maybe one state. California's got the most. They've got 7 task forces for their state. But when you look at that task force, it mobilizes. There's a 6-hour window just to be able to get your people, equipment, and to start to respond. And then you've got basically the wheels-up time element to be able to get there. Knowing that a response comes in, and if the Clackamas trailer was going to move, we mobilize the trailer. We start to get the personnel to a staging point to be able to group the personnel, equipment, and supplies, and then being able to respond in. We would also enhance that with what we call an advance team. We send an advance team into that incident, jurisdiction having authority, and what we'll do is we'll talk to the incident commander to see how they would like to use the urban search and rescue or how we can do it. If we need other trailers, then we can start to mobilize those trailers as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. George Crozier, is that how you pronounce it?
Thank you. Chair Shields and Chair Westland, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here. My name is George Crozier. I am a deputy with the Office of State Fire Marshal. I also am the president of the AFSCME bargaining unit for the employees of the Office of State Fire Marshal. And I appreciate this opportunity to spend some time here visiting about our budget as it is before you. And specifically, I'm here today to support the governor's recommended budget that has been presented to you to support the Office of State Fire Marshal and our prevention programs, the Oregon State Police Arson Investigation Unit, and the fire programs of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. These programs, as supported by this budget, should meet the needs of the Oregonians, including our visitors, and they will make sure that those needs are met in an efficient manner and in cooperation with the Oregon Fire Service. Those programs also will provide services that yield consistent results that meet or exceed our customers' expectations. And those same services will also result in effective outcomes that we've identified, and I have a few further down in my comments here. In collaboration with the fire service throughout the state of Oregon, the services provided through this budget include services such as fire prevention education, emergency readiness training and resources, investigations of fires, and providing for the safety of persons in buildings and facilities and during community and area-wide activities and events. Because I've been with the State Fire Marshal's Office for over 23 years, I have a lot of experiences that I could draw upon, but I picked out four examples of outcomes that are not only have occurred but are ongoing and expandable into the future. The first one I mentioned here is the work to prevent novelty cigarette lighters from getting into the hands of juveniles. We work very diligently to make sure that these toy-like lighters are not with the situation where juveniles can get their hands on them. We teach kids that playing with fire is an inappropriate behavior, and so we have programs to encourage that, and indeed are working not only within the state but nationally. We've set up a process where we're working with other states to endorse and move this forward. Secondarily, we also provide fire prevention and investigation and suppression training to both career and volunteer firefighters to help them more effectively serve their communities. We do spend a lot of time with the volunteer and more rural departments, but we do provide an across-the-board fire service training as a part of the fire programs at DPSST. The fire prevention programs help fire chiefs, fire marshals at the local level, as well as other interested staff to make sure that they are following the consistency of the Oregon Fire Code so that the application of that code to the safety of Oregonians is uniform and consistent throughout. The investigation training also assists local fire people who typically in the smaller rural departments especially do not have a lot of fires to respond to on a year-in, year-out basis to make sure that they have the sufficient skills to recognize the problems that they encounter and determine the causes of these fires. We also talk about the investigations of fires by teams of fire and law enforcement officers to ensure determination of fire causes and identifying those responsible. We work closely as the State Fire Marshal with our law enforcement partners in the State Police Arson Unit. Specifically, those detectives have the skills in the law enforcement side. As deputies, we have the skills in the determination of fire cause. And together, we're able to not only find out where the fire started, but why they started and potentially the people that may have caused them to start. The best example I can use is here a few years ago in Benton County. I worked with a local fire chief. And between the arson detective and myself, we were able within the day of the fire to identify the person who had caused the fire and was able to get that individual to admit to their guilt. And it did result eventually in a positive outcome in the court system. We also have make provisions for conducting inspections in buildings or facilities to prevent loss of life and property involving high-risk individuals such as the elderly, such as the young, people who have challenges in those ways, and in other hazardous conditions and circumstances that could potentially result in the financial losses for local communities and possible increases in insurance costs for businesses and individuals. I would ask for your support of our budget as presented in the Governor's recommended budget. And speaking on behalf of the employees of the Office of State Fire Marshal, thank you very much for your time. And I'd be available for any questions that you might have.
Senator Winters, then Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. How many fires did your team from your operation investigate during the biennium?
For the entire, Senator Winters, for the entire agency?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't have the hard numbers for the entire agency. I can say that on a deputy basis, we typically will investigate anywhere from as few as, say, 12 to 15 fires to as many as 25 or 30, 40 fires per deputy, and we have 17 deputies around the state of Oregon. So those are the numbers that the deputies investigate.
Could you, you don't have to do it now, I don't want you to think off the top of your head, could you get those numbers to us?
I'm sure that we can get those.
And of those that are investigated, how many, could you let us know how many were arsons?
I'm sure we can get that number too.
If you could get it to the professional staff, they'll distribute it.
Okay, we'll do that.
Senator Westland.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. A couple months ago, maybe several of us saw this story on a couple of the major local broadcast networks, but there I am laying in bed trying to go to sleep, and flash on the screen comes the story on the animated character toy lighter thing, and I just immediately thought, well, there's the fire marshal's office doing their job, because that just wasn't created out of thin air, and so I appreciate your... I was shocked. I had no idea.
Committee members, Senator Westland, we were surprised that it has taken on its own life of its own to the level that it has, but we also have had some very creative staff that have done some really hard work working with our partners to collaborate and try and come up with ways to get this taken care of, including Consumer Product Safety Commission and others.
Great, thank you very much.
Okay,
thank you. Jenna Ingram. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. Jenna Ingram, Executive Director of the Oregon Fire District Directors Association. We are here to wholeheartedly support the governor's budget. Just a very brief overview of the Oregon Fire District Directors. They are elected officials, just like yourselves, who are elected by their constituents to represent or to make decisions that are on the in the best interest of the public and the public safety community to protect the public. Many of those individuals come from the fire service. They are either retired and they don't fight fires any longer, but they still want to be a part of the fire service community, and they run for the board. Others come from other walks of life. They may be teachers, contractors, other individuals who have no public safety experience. And for that reason, the training portion of the services that the fire marshal provides and DPSST are crucial to the decision-making ability of those individuals. The one complaint that I get the most, the calls that I get into my office, are from the rural fire protection districts in the outlying areas not having access to enough of training opportunities. Because many of them are volunteers and they have regular jobs, training for them, if the training isn't brought to them, then training often means taking vacation time to come up to Salem to take the courses as they are made available. So for that reason, and that is one of the reasons we fought so vehemently to protect the fire insurance premium tax, because we were hoping to see an expansion of those training opportunities. In addition to that, the arson investigation is an integral part of the services provided by the state fire marshal, and additionally the fire prevention, including the inspection functions that are performed by the Office of the State Fire Marshal. By focusing on those the prevention techniques and the teaching and the educating the public like they do, that then saves the resources of our small rural fire protection districts. With regard to training, there are just so many things. If you haven't been a part of the fire service or the public safety service, as I said, many of these directors are not. Just things like land use issues relating to the formation of a fire district, the Conflagration Act and understanding that, even down to ethics, as I know Senator Brown understands, just all of these things that help educate those individuals to make the best decisions. I want to say at this point that currently those directors are not a part of the training program. Last interim, the Oregon Fire District Directors Association did hold our first Directors Training Institute. I want to thank the law firm of Speer Hoyt from Eugene, who volunteered their entire time, their entire day, to educate fire district directors on some of the public safety points and how to be a good director and how to make the best decisions for public safety. Had they not donated that seminar for free, we would not have been able to put it on. So training is something that is very, very important to us, very dear to our hearts. And should additional funds be made available, we would like to see it go to additional training, not just for the firefighters themselves, which we think is absolutely important, but also for those individuals who must make decisions on behalf of the constituents of the fire districts. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thanks for your testimony. Rick Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. AARP has over 500,000 members in Oregon, and we survey those members on a regular basis. The results of those surveys indicate that our members are becoming increasingly concerned about public safety, and specifically safety on our highways. Because of that, and because of phone calls and emails I get from members, I even got a resolution from one of our chapters, and they'd done the appropriate whereases and so forth. I wish I would have remembered it this morning as I rushed out of the office. I would have brought it with me. But again, their resolution was indicating support for additional funding for state troopers. Obviously, the governor's budget recognized the need for 24-hour coverage. As indicated, I don't think the co-chair's budget at this point does, and we just wanted to offer our support for the funding for those additional troopers. Thank you very much.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Lana Butterfield.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Propane Gas Association. Our association has been regulated by the state fire marshal for longer than I've been alive, and that's a long time. And we think we're not here to complain about anything, but simply to support the state fire marshal's office. It's very well run. We have utmost regard for Fire Marshal Nancy Orr and her staff, and we urge your support.
Brilliant testimony. Yeah. Any questions?
could have shaved six words off of that.
Thank you, Lana. Kelly Bach.
Chairman Shields, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Bach. I'm the president of the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and I'm also a line captain for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue and a member of our technical rescue team for 4 years prior to a promotion. Although I support the entire budget, my comments here today are in support of the USAR funding specifically for training. Currently, as you've heard the testimony earlier today, it's a statewide team with three different areas, and a common problem is the ability to have the members trained to respond to the disasters when they do occur. We've received a lot of nice vans and trailers and equipment, but what's lacking is training. And we think that since it is a statewide team, statewide resource, that funding should come, at least some of it, from the state to support the men and women that are actually on the street performing these essential functions. So that's really all my comments. If you have any other questions, I'd be glad to take them.
Thank you very much for your testimony. All right, colleagues, we're done with public testimony, I believe. Is anybody else here to testify on this budget? Great. Thank you all for coming in. We'll shift gears and get back to the agency budget then. Anything you'd like to set up, Mr. Wilson?
This is the Fish and Wildlife Division, and Captain Marquis is the testifier, and then tomorrow we'll finish up the state police with admin services and closing comments and remarks by the superintendent.
And then, colleagues, we are not meeting, by the way, on Thursday and Friday because full ways and means we'll be out of time. When you are, Mr. McKee.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Walt Marquis, Captain of the Fish and Wildlife Division. I supervise 119 Oregon State police officers who are assigned to the Fish and Wildlife Division. These troopers are strategically stationed throughout the state of Oregon in order to protect Oregon's natural resources. The Fish and Wildlife Division of the Oregon State Police is the only enforcement entity designated by law to protect the fish and wildlife resources throughout the state. The division has formed partnerships with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, the Oregon State Marine Board, and the Department of Environmental Quality. By forming these partnerships, the division is able to work or to provide enforcement work which helps further the mission of these other agencies. I would like to start my testimony today by telling you about four different key budget drivers or workload trends that is affecting how division serves the citizens of Oregon. The first budget driver which affects how the division does its business is new laws and regulations. In order for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to meet the resource management goals while still offering as much opportunity to the public as possible, new laws and regulations are adopted. These new laws are sometimes passed by legislation, but are more often passed by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission. When a new law or regulation is introduced, the Fish and Wildlife Division is sometimes required to reorganize our resources and our priorities. Because the division's budget is comprised of 85% dedicated funding, this leaves very little room to maneuver when trying to meet our agency needs. Let me give you an example. During the past year, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission passed an administrative rule which set limits on how many commercial crab pots any particular commercial crabber may have in the ocean at any one time. This was done at the urging of the commercial crab community with the goal to provide fresh crab over a longer period of time, which added some needed stability to this economically critical fishery. For several years now, Dungeness crab has been Oregon's largest fishery, which brings millions of dollars to Oregon's economy. This regulation requires a large offshore vessel for adequate enforcement. Oregon is the only coastal state in the United States which does not have a large offshore boat with enforcement capability. The division has several rigid hull boats that we currently operate offshore. However, these vessels do not have the ability to pull crab pots or to work offshore in bad weather. Stopgap measures are currently being used, such as partnering with Oregon and California to use their large offshore vessels to patrol Oregon waters for several days with Oregon Fish and Wildlife officers on board. The only cost to Oregon in this case was the fuel to run the vessels. By being resourceful, the division managed to effectively enforce the new crab pot rule this year. However, a long-term solution must be found to effectively enforce this new rule. The second budget driver I want to talk about is calls for service. The division has documented that we are responding to a growing number of calls for service regarding public interaction with large predators such as bears, cougars, and wolves. Bear compliance hours are 21% higher than the previous six-year average. barrel violations have increased 29% over the same six-year period. Cougar compliance hours in the last 2 years have increased 12%. Cougar violations have increased 57% over the last 6 years. The division started tracking wolves in late 2006, and we have no comparisons at this time. The division is currently working to provide additional training for troopers on how to deal with the possible...
Captain?
Yes, sir.
You have... Thank you, Captain. Just talk about the wolves for a moment. Have you had wolf sightings by your folks in Oregon?
By my troopers?
By your troopers?
No, not that I'm aware of, no. We have the public that have sighted wolves and will call, or damage complaints or such, they think it might be wolves, they'll call us and we'll respond.
Can I follow up just briefly? It shows the division started tracking wolves in late 2006, but not tracking wolves literally, but tracking the data, correct?
Yes, I'm referring to the data that are just the time and the effort that our troops spend in the field, not the actual wolves.
Thank you.
The division is currently working to provide additional training for troopers on how to deal with the possibility of a large predator attacking a citizen, how to handle sightings of large predators by citizens, and educating the public on methods to prevent large predator contact. The third budget driver I would like to talk about is Oregon's increasing population. Large population increases in portions of Oregon have exceeded our ability to provide adequate enforcement programs that we have in other areas of our state. In these areas, troopers mainly respond to individual complaints for service and are able to dedicate proactive enforcement efforts towards identified high-priority programs to gain voluntary compliance, which is what we use to measure our success. For example, Deschutes County is one of Oregon's premier locations for both resident and non-residents to enjoy outdoor activity. The population in Deschutes County has increased 54% from 1990 to 2000 and has increased an additional 22.5% since the year 2000. In addition, there are upwards of 90,000 people visiting Oregon, Central Oregon communities as tourists, sportsmen, campers, or boaters. The compliance rate for wildlife violations in this area is 10% below the statewide average and 5% below the statewide average for fishing activities. The fourth budget driver I want to address is the division's staffing level and recruitment. Historically, the Fish and Wildlife Division recruited its members who have a specialized skill set from the Patrol Division. Over time, the Patrol Division has been depleted through budget cuts, which has reduced our pool of Fish and Wildlife applicants. This has made it difficult to fill vacancies within the Fish and Wildlife Division. Early in my career, the waiting list to work in the Fish and Wildlife Division was so long that a trooper was required to work 2 years in the Patrol Division before they could work in the Fish and Wildlife Division. During the recent years, the division has started recruiting and hiring recruits with the skill sets we are looking for directly into the Fish and Wildlife Division. Currently, the division has 6% vacancy rate, which equates to 6 vacancies. The vacancy rate is down from past years, where vacancies have been as high as 10%. Even though we still have vacancies within the Fish and Wildlife Division, we have recently been able to do a better job filling those vacancies. We continue to look for officers with the passion and desire to apply their skills as a Fish and Wildlife officer. During the last biennium, the division implemented several improvements which made us more efficient. The division instituted a new web-based reporting system where the troopers manually enter the time and activities they perform each day. This system eliminated one support position which entered the data the troopers provided and significantly reduced the time that it takes command staff to access the data. It used to take up to 6 months to access the data to where we are now able to access the data immediately. A second efficiency the division implemented was we hired 2 limited duration support staff through a federal grant. One of these positions compiles reports which are required by various state and federal agencies. This position has reduced the workload of 15 supervisors and 26 troopers and the command staff at General Headquarters. The second position researches commercial fish landing data and provides support documentation to officers in the field for violations. Let me spend a few minutes telling you about the division's performance measures. The division has 3 performance measures which we track for the legislature, which helps us measure how successful we are. Through our new web-based tracking system, the division has the ability to track all wildlife the troopers come in contact with while on patrol. This information can be broken down by species, water body, or hunt unit, allowing the division to measure user impacts on various species. Once this information is collated, the information is used to evaluate programs, compliance rates, enforcement, patrols, and assigned position locations. The first measure is Oregon State Police Performance Measure 4. This measures angler compliance by using the percent of anglers contacted who are angling in compliance with rules and laws associated with salmon and steelhead bag limits, licensing and tagging, including means of take and species. This performance measure has been in place for several years and has a target rate of 85%. The division actual compliance rate in 2006 was 90.7%. The second measure is Oregon State Police Performance Measure Number 5. This measures angler compliance by using the percent of anglers contacted who are in compliance with the rules and laws associated with all species. This performance measure was put into place in the 2005 legislative session. The target rate of compliance for the performance measure is 85%. The division's actual compliance rate in 2006 was 89.6%. The third measure is Oregon State Police Performance Measure Number 6. This measures hunter compliance by using the percentage of hunters contacted who are hunting in compliance with the rules and laws associated with big game hunting seasons. This performance measure was put in place in the 2005 legislative session. The target rate of compliance for the performance measure is 87%. The division's actual compliance rate in 2006 was 86.9%. To summarize, the Fish and Wildlife Division met our goals for our statewide performance measures. However, as I already testified, in certain areas of Oregon, such as Deschutes County, where population trends has affected staffing levels, ability to be proactive, we have fallen below our goals. Some key legislation currently pending which could affect the division is Senate Bill 101. Under current law, the Oregon State Parks is allowed to spend monies it receives from all-terrain vehicle program to pay enforcement agencies to enforce laws pertaining to all-terrain vehicles in areas where it is open to operate these vehicles. Currently, the division spends approximately 2,000 hours per year enforcing laws pertaining to the users of all-terrain vehicles. This amount of time equates to approximately 1.5 full-time employees. And the majority of our enforcement is in areas where the use of these vehicles is closed. During the hunting seasons, our number one complaint is all-terrain vehicles operating in closed areas. Senate Bill 101 would allow Oregon State Parks to allocate funds from their all-terrain vehicle program to fund the work the division currently performs regarding all-terrain vehicles being operated in areas closed to these vehicles. I would conclude my testimony today with some information in regards to the division's three policy option packages. Policy Option Package 101, this is the division's portion of the overall policy option package requesting to restore the department's agency-wide infrastructure. Policy Option Package 305 is a crab pot enforcement. As I testified earlier, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission implemented a crab pot limit on the commercial crab industry. This new program requires all commercial crab pots in the ocean, both coastal and deep water, to be marked with a tag identifying the owner of the pot. For this program to be successful, it requires a dedicated enforcement effort by the Fish and Wildlife Division. To effectively patrol this fishery, the Fish and Wildlife Division needs a boat capable of operating in deep water to inspect buoy tags, crab pots, and to pull the unlawful crab pots from the ocean floor. In addition, once the crab pot fishing season is closed, any crab pots left in the ocean are unlawfully fishing and must be removed as evidence and for preservation of the resource. Policy Option Package 305 is requesting the one-time authority to spend $140,000 after his transfer from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to lease an ocean-going vessel and crew for approximately 46 days split equally over 2 years. This lease would cover all the expenses for renting the vessel, skipper, and crew wage, fuel, and any other associated expenditure. Fish and Wildlife Division members would accompany the crew on these deep water enforcement patrols, which would be performed from various ports in Oregon. Division has set a goal of 85% compliance rate regarding commercial crab violations. This policy option package will allow the division to achieve our goal of identifying gear and individuals engaging in unlawful deep water crabbing, stop the practice, and retrieve any equipment in violation in order to achieve the division's goal of 85% compliance. Policy option package 318, position reclass and adjustments. In 2005 and 07, the division received funding through a federal grant. A portion of this grant allowed the division to hire two separate positions to assist in support of the Federal Joint Enforcement Agreement, which is a federal program which enhances our ability to enforce commercial fisheries. These positions directly support requirements outlined in the grant, which require agencies to share their reporting through the collection of data and compiling information. This same grant has authorized this funding to continue through 2008. I expect this grant to extend into the future for several years. This policy option package requests the authority to spend the money received through this grant to support these positions. These positions provide direct support to General Headquarters staff through preparation of correspondence, reports, statistical data, budget documents, and oversight of assigned projects. This concludes my testimony. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them for you.
Senator Brown. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Winters was first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I know.
just a quick question. I'm looking at the enforcement of the violation of the crab pots. And you mentioned there that there were over 200 violations were detected. Are there fines associated with those violations? If so, how much?
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, that case is still pending. It has not been adjudicated this time, but I fully expect that there will be fines.
So that was one entity that had 200 violations?
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, since we did not have an offshore boat, we partnered with the state of Washington to bring their boat down from Washington and patrol the northern Oregon coast, and we partnered with California to bring their boat up from California and patrol the south coast. And we put troopers on both of those boats for 2 days. And in 2 days, we locate over 200 violations.
But my question is, does either one of the, whether it's Washington, California, or Oregon, is there a fine associated with the individuals when they're caught?
Yes, there is.
How much?
It would depend on the fine. It would depend on the violation.
Was that responsive, Senator?
Well, who receives the revenue?
The Chair Shields, Senator Winters. It's a county venue, so it would go to the county that the violation occurred in, directly offshore of that county. It would be tried in that venue, and then if there's any fines assessed, it would be through the normal court system. If you would like, I could gather up what the fines were and what the citations were on that particular patrol. Let you know what the typical violation was along with the typical fine.
That would be, because as we look to the future, even though, you know, you mentioned and indicated that this was a federal grant, at some point federal grants run out, mm-hmm. and we need to look at sustainability and what's going to happen in the future.
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, in this particular patrol, I think that the individuals that were cited didn't necessarily know that we were going to be patrolling. If they knew that we had an offshore boat, I would not expect to see that many violations. That helps.
And, Ms. Markey, will that take a whole lot of effort to get to compile that information, or would it be pretty simple to do?
Chair Shields, I think it'd be fairly simple.
Senator Brown? Right.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Captain Markey, thanks for your time. I assume you're not related to either Jim or Matt.
Chair Shields, Senator Brown, yes, depends on, actually, but Jim is my uncle and Matt is my cousin.
Oh, you are related. Now you're in big related. Trouble. Okay. Mr. Chair, can I ask
me to
a substantive question now?
Oh, hold on, my chair.
Just for the record, I think we should get on the record that Senator Brown was only kidding.
Yes, I was only kidding. I didn't think you were related. So on page 105, you have this nice little chart here, and I'm having a little trouble reading it, and you have to – I didn't do very well in math, which is why I became a lawyer. So I'm just looking at the Cougars, and it looks like you had 961 hours of Cougars hours in 2001 and only 731 in 2006 with about the same number of contacts. And I'm not understanding that reads, and maybe it's just I assume NIC is not in compliance.
Referring to the 6 of 7?
Yeah.
Brown?
Yes.
If you go across, the first column is the year. The second column is the species, and you're looking specifically at the cougar. And the hours there is how many hours our troopers spent working on cougar issues.
Okay.
And then the contacts is how many different, I'd say, contacts. There might be 6 people there when you got there, but it's counted as one contact because it's one incident.
So it's interaction with cougar.
Interaction, yes.
Okay.
And then the next one would be how many of those were not in compliance.
Okay.
So the first column, 302 contacts, 23 were not in compliance.
Compliance with what?
The law. It means they received a citation.
Okay. All right.
Or warning.
All right. Mr. Chair, just for the record, I'm sort of surprised at the fact that the numbers have been, in terms of our contacts, given what I was understanding happened with Cougars, I'm just surprised that the hours and the contacts in 01 and 06 are relatively the same. I'm just sort of surprised at that. Not the hours and the contacts. The hours went down and the contacts is about the same. The compliance is what's gone up. The not in compliance, I'm sorry, has gone up. So.
Did you want to respond to that, or should I? Representative Barker, then Representative
In Central Oregon, I shared this with Superintendent Rucker 2 years ago. I was over at Eagle Crest, and a friend of mine from Washington went to get a fishing license to
That's a good question.
And they said, oh, you don't need to buy the state police, never come on our property. And I know you're shorthanded, but I'm hoping, and just as you're saying, like, if people... The compliance in the ocean would, of course, apply the same thing to the rivers. Lots of people think troopers are around, they would be selling him a license. He wanted to buy one, actually. They would, they just, this point of information, nothing. I'm not being critical. I hope you can encourage those guys to drop by Eagle Crest once in a while.
Chair Shields, Representative Barker, I appreciate the information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Captain Markey, the statement about game officers being able to track game that they come across and so forth and tie that into the fish and wildlife folks, does that also allow you to, in for example, in hunt units where, because Fish and Wildlife has really quite remarkable statistics about how many people applied for a certain tag in a unit and that kind of thing, can you then do staffing based on that in terms of if you know what unit has X amount of hunters in it and so forth, can you apply that to staffing?
Chair Shields, Representative Hanna, yes. And we actually work very closely with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Each year in the month of February, our local game officers sit down with the local fish and wildlife biologist, and we go over what we call cooperative enforcement planning, and we together set what the priorities are for the year. And, for instance, maybe in eastern Oregon, we know that the large buck deer come down into the winter range, and they're very vulnerable because they're in the open and they still have their antlers. They haven't dropped their antlers yet. So we know that that's a priority in November to protect those large buck. So our officer in that area, there may only be one officer, he knows that he can't patrol that area himself. So he would write an action plan based upon our CEP that we just did with the local biologist. And the action plan might require to bring in officers from outside the area for periods of time during the week while he's off or doing something else. And so we direct our staffing directly towards the data that we collect and partner with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And so during the action plan, we would provide adequate coverage for that particular patrol. And then once the patrol was over, in the month of November passed, an after-action report would be written documenting our success or not success and how we might be more successful in the future.
Representative Kinnaman, then Senator Ventures.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Captain Markey, for being here. That just raised a flag in my mind because I remember being checked by Scarpone one day, and the next day I had a federal guy come out and check me in the same area. Is there a working relationship with the feds?
Representative Shields, or Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, yes, there is. We, I assume if the feds were checking, you must have been duck hunting or goose hunting, but we often do joint patrols with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Services. I can't say that every patrol we go on, we don't tell the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service what we're doing or they report to us. But just like, for instance, for tomorrow, we're working on a joint investigation. I'm going for a briefing, and we're going to be talking about tomorrow afternoon about how we can better partner and stuff. So the answer is generally a yes, but not always.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Captain Markey. The citations that are issued there in Cougar, how do they respond?
Representative Shields, Senator, how did the cougars and bears respond? usually they pass by the time we get there.
Seriously, were these citations issued to individuals who owned cougars and bears, but who had them? I'm just saying,
no.
Who gets cited?
Representative Shields, Senator Winters. Typically, these kinds of citations go to people who are either hunting bears with hounds unlawfully, or possibly baiting bears, or without a tag, closed season, things like that.
Just needed to clarify it so that people that are listening to us know what we're talking about.
Okay.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a quick comment that on page 102 in our book, where the continuous improvements and efficiencies are noted, I just wanted to say I feel really proud to read information like this. I'm very pleased to see what the new technology does. It eliminates a position, but also it improves service from days and days to having information available on demand, basically instantly. This is really good to read these kinds of reports from the departments, and I hope that we continue to see reports like this. I just wanted to express appreciation and acknowledge what you've done. Say thanks.
Chair Shields, Representative, thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you, Captain Markey, for your testimony, and thank you for your work. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.